We're starting a show now called The Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests, or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com. In tonight's show, we play with absurdism. We artists take contemporary events and turn it into art. Well, we are smack in the middle of an absurdist epoch of humanity. So we'll take some left turns from normalcy tonight. We're going full orthogonal. That means at right angles. We start the show with a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone, the can opener. Tonight we'll hear music by Jean-Michel Jarre from his album called Zuluk. Zuluk is one of the most brilliant, fun, and absurdist albums I've ever heard, which I bet you haven't yet. Selections will be interspersed with selections from classic literature and speeches with an orthogonal twist. You'll see. And then we wrap up the show with a story I wrote called The Dangers of Helium. Stay tuned.
I walk 3 days a week with my friend Peter. We start at the intersection of Ocean and Montana Sundays, Tuesdays, and Thursdays. Now you know where to find me on those days. I'm the guy in the red Kauai hat. Peter will have on a white hat with an O on it. His son is a graduate of the University of Oregon. He's a duck, not a beaver. If any members of the Proud Boys want to assassinate me, I'll be the guy holding the Airedale on the leash. Shoot me. Don't hurt Annie the Airedale. Annie is a political agnostic. She will vote for whomever gives her a chicken treat. We walk all the way to the end of the world-famous Santa Monica Pier, then back to Ocean in Montana. In that we are men of a certain age, our route is determined by the view, which is unparalleled, and the access to restrooms, which are plentiful and clean enough. Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, 6 million people a year used to come and walk down the ramp to enter the pier. The pier was closed for several months at the beginning of the pandemic. That cut down the length of our walk from 3 miles to 2 miles, a truncated walk, but still stunningly beautiful. We walk in Palisades Park. It's a narrow park ranging from 30 feet wide to 150 feet wide and probably 2 miles long. It clings to the top of a cliff that rises about 100 feet overlooking the Pacific Coast Highway, some amazing houses, and 200 yards of the most beautiful sandy beach, and then the surf of the Pacific Ocean. The park has a permanent crew that are there every morning mowing and edging and raking and removing trash and planting and watering and generally loving that park. One of my classmates at the horticulture program in UCLA, Barack, used to be responsible for 5 blocks of the Palisades Park. Their feeling for the park shows in their work. Palisades Park is a stunningly beautiful park. Green grass, palm trees, roses, Dracaena draco, aloe striata, aloe arborescens, giant bird of paradise, various agaves, some eucalyptus, a few California conifers, yucca, pride of Madeira. It's something to see. I feel so blessed to be able to walk through it as much as I do. We find stuff on our walk. Peter's remarkable. He can see a copper penny in the street from 30 feet. It is not uncommon for us to find over a dollar on our walks. It is amazing the effect of finding a quarter has on Peter. His day is made. The coins get wrapped up and deposited into Peter's account. If we find any jewelry, I get to keep it. Lots of cheap earrings, but we did find a diamond once. I found a nice gold chain last week. Last week, I also found a can opener, a P-38 Army issue John Wayne C-ration opener. So what, a can opener? Yes, a can opener. A small manual can opener about 1.5 inches long and 1/2 inch wide. This thing is so small you can put it on your keychain. It even has a hole in it for just that purpose. I showed it to Peter. He had no idea what it was. I told him and then threw it away. After a trip to the restroom on the pier, I went back to the trash can and reached my hand in to retrieve the can opener. Thank goodness the cleaning crew had just emptied the trash and put a new bag in the can. I didn't have to dig around. Peter asked why I had gone back for a cheap, worthless can opener. Who needs a manual can opener today? Most cans have tabs on them. I will tell you why. When I was 5, I think my father wanted to foster a closer relationship with me, so we started fishing every weekend. Every weekend. Rain or shine, hot or cold, every weekend from the age of 5 until I discovered girls. Maybe he just wanted to get away from Mama for a while. We started pond fishing with poles. If you've ever been around a 5-year-old, you will know that why we stayed on the banks of ponds for the first year. There's a lot more splashing around than fishing happening. Lots of sunfish, bream, and the occasional bass and catfish. We moved on to streams, creeks, and rivers. Daddy and I also used a boat for fishing on Lake Sinclair for white perch, Pomoxus anolaris, or crappie in the local vernacular. Why anyone would name a great-tasting panfish crappie is beyond me. But we fished for crappie using minnows at night using Coleman lanterns that hung over both sides of the boat. The idea was the light would attract fish and the fish would bite our minnows. Hot or cold, we fished for crappie. Sometimes in the winter it would be so cold that ice would form on the minnow bucket between baiting your hooks. Sometimes the fog would come in so that we would be forced to stay on the lake all night until the sun came up and burned off the fog. Those were some long nights. Most often we caught fish. The catch would be placed in an ice chest that also had soft drinks in it. Those cokes, always cokes, had sort of a slimy feel and taste to them after a good night's fishing. Sunday, after church, Daddy and I cleaned fish. Lots of scaling with the occasional skinning of a catfish. Catfish are tough. Even after being on ice for 12 hours, they would still be alive and would fin you if you were not careful. The Sunday evening meal was more often than not fresh fish at my house. If we caught a lot of fish, a mess of fish in the native vernacular, we would invite neighbors. Fried fish, hush puppies, tartar sauce, coleslaw, and sweet tea. My mouth is watering just reading this. One of the things about fishing is you have to have bait. Bait shops sold all manner of bait. Worms, red wigglers and pinks, crickets, minnows, goldfish, leeches, liver, all sorts of specialty bait, mainly for catfish. There were lures, hooks, weights, flies, monofilament line, poles, rods, reels, clothing, ice chests, ice. It was paradise for fishermen. My favorite was gray bait and tackle. It was right on Route 129, the gray highway on the way to Lake Sinclair. After getting all of your fishing supplies for the day or night, there was an aisle for food, human food, or at least some semblance of human food. This was the food that was meant for men to eat while fishing. This was not dainty stuff to be eaten with the fork. It was to be eaten with your hands. If you've never fished with a pink worm, let me tell you that when you place a hook in said pink worm, all sorts of worm juice spews out and covers your fingers, and it's hard to get off, almost impossible. So, when you open your fried peach pie that had been on the shelf at the Gray Bait and Tackle for the last year, there was worm juice on your hands. The trick is to not put your fingers in your mouth for the sake of cleanliness. One thing I can't stand is nastiness. There was also a section in Gray's for meat. Not hamburger or chicken, except in the bait aisle, but meat in cans. This meat that was already was prepared for consumption. Potted meat, Spam, Vienna sausages, beanie weenies, pork and beans, sardines, and more. Potted meat, for you uninitiated, is made of, quote, various meats such as beef, pork, chicken, turkey, and organ meats, end quote. It's ground up fine and processed with goodness only knows what and canned. It's tasty. There was always a giant round of cheese on the counter as well. A half a pound of cheese, a box of saltine crackers, four or five Cokes, and some potted meat and beanie weenies, and you were ready to go fishing. None of these cans had pop tops on them. You had to use your knife. Everyone has a knife in their pocket, right? Or you had to have a can opener. What you needed is the exact P-38 can opener that Daddy had on his keychain for the last 60 years. When he died, he had a P-38 can opener that looked exactly like the one I found. A notch was placed on the lip of the can, and the hawkbill piece of the can opener was folded out, and when the long piece was moved back and forward, the hawkbill sharp piece would pierce the can. You had to work slowly around the can, but it was easier and safer than using a pocket knife on a rocking boat. And if you had it on your keychain, let's eat. So I picked up this can opener on the Santa Monica Pier, and all these memories came flooding back to me. I don't think I'm going to put this can opener on my keychain. I don't fish anymore, and most cans have some sort of opening device built into them. But seeing this one was a trip down memory lane for me.
We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Article I. Section 1. All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and House of Representatives. Article 2. Section 1. The executive power shall be vested in a President of the United States of America. He shall hold his office during the term of 4 years, and, together with the Vice President, chosen for the same term.
First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Fifth Amendment. No person shall be held to answer for a capital, or otherwise infamous crime, unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces, or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger, nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property, without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use, without just compensation.
First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Fifth Amendment. No person shall be held to answer for a capital, or otherwise infamous crime, unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces, or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger, nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property, without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use, without just compensation.
Animo. Animo bo. O sa. Animo. A ga te so so. The Salome Ixe Ixra Ix Tatu B O Casal Ixa Ixra Cucuno
Nos
Holiday
Holiday Ba Lay
Lay
Akano Kasaomi Oni Alaoni Te Kura Aso Tata Tsi Do
Indeed, Fourscore and 7 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty, and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But, in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow, this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it, far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note, nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
Fourscore and 7 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation, or any nation so conceived and so dedicated, can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here, have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or detract. The world will little note, nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender, and even if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle, until, in God's good time, the New World, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a day. Sometimes too hot the eye of heaven shines, and too often is his gold complexion dimmed. And every fair from fair sometimes declines, by chance or nature's changing course entrimmed, by thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest, nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in eternal lines to time thou growest. So long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee.
Eye of newt, and toe of frog, wool of bat, and tongue of dog, adder's fork, and blind worm's sting, lizard's leg, and olet's wing, for a charm of powerful trouble, like a hell broth boil and bubble. Double, double toil and trouble, fire burn and cauldron bubble.
To be, or not to be, that is the question, whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep, no more, and by sleep, to say we end the heartache, and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to. 'Tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep, perchance to dream, aye, there's the rub, for in that sleep of death, what dreams may come, when we have shuffled off this mortal coil, must give us pause. There's the respect that makes calamity of so long life, For who would bear the whips and scorns of time, the oppressor's wrong, the proud man's contumely, the pangs of despised love, the law's delay, the insolence of office, and the spurns that patient merit of unworthy takes, when he himself might his quietus make with a bare bodkin? Who would fardels bear, these fardels, to grunt and sweat under a weary life, but that the dread of something after death, the undiscovered country, from whose bourne no traveller returns, puzzles the will, and makes us rather bear those ills we have, than fly to others that we know not of? Thus conscience does make cowards of us all, and thus the native hue of resolution is sickly door, with the pale cast of thought, and enterprises of great pitch and moment, pith, with this regard their currents turn awry, away, and lose the name of action. Soft you now, the fair Ophelia. Nymph, in thy orisons be all my sins remembered. One me is Joanna. I will read any text you type here.
To be, or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of rebels, and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep, no more, and by a sleep, to say we end the heartache, and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to, 'tis a consummation devoutly to be wished, to die, to sleep, perchance to dream, aye, bear the rub, for in that sleep of death what dreams may come, when we have shuffled off this mortal coil, must give us pause, there the respect that makes calamity of so long life. For who would bear the whips and scorns of time, the oppressor's wrong, the proud man's contumely, the pangs of despised love, the law's delay, the insolence of office, and the spurns that patient merit of unworthy takes, when he himself might his quietus make with a bare bodkin? Who would fardels bear, these fardels, to grunt and sweat under a weary life, but that the dread of something after death, the undiscovered country, from whose bourne no traveller returns, puzzles the will, and makes us rather bear those ills we have, than fly to others that we know not of? Thus conscience does make cowards of us all, and thus the native hue of resolution is a cleaner, with the pale cast of thought, and enterprises of great pitch and moment, with this regard their currents turn awry, away, and lose the name of action. Soft you now, the fair Ophelia. Nymph, in thy orisons be all my sins remembered. One.
Thank you.
The following is the first substantial story I ever wrote. At the time, I had worked for several years in what felt like a prison, a law office with an incompetent, abusive attorney for a boss. I got very sick with a high fever. In the depths of the illness, this story started coming to me, and I wrote a few words now and then throughout a difficult afternoon. It was like pulling pieces of information out of a distant part of myself that I had never visited. However, the more that I wrote, the better I felt. When I got the whole story on paper, which is a very flat, thin material people used to write on way back in 1991, the fever had broken, and I felt all better. Art heals. Actually, when I completed this tale, I felt a non-drug high. Well, it must be said that I'm very sensitive to medication, and it may have been the aspirin. But seriously, a kind of ecstasy comes with creation, and this first act of creating brought rapture in full measure. I didn't know at the time that I really am a storyteller and a very artsy kind of guy, and it took a couple more crises for me to extricate myself from that horrible law office in a building called the Maralta Plaza in Culver City. It was my first job with serious responsibility, but it's funny how we can put up with abuse because it has been normalized and we don't understand it should not be tolerated. I didn't know that I really, really had to leave there, and I almost died in one of the other crises before it came clear. But that's a story for another time. The following piece, That I Pulled Out of the Heavens During a Moment of Hell, was a beacon for me to follow that led me to what I needed to be doing with my life, which is exactly what I'm doing right this very minute. The Dangers of Helium by Mystic Pete. Bear with me for a brief explanation of some science, and then I'll get to the story. In the field of electricity, resistance is a term which describes how electricity gets transformed into heat instead of retaining its wattage. Resistance is the opposition to the flow of current. The opposite of resistance is conductance, the ease with which a current passes. Computers, batteries, motors, the flow of electricity that comes from the sockets in your home become more efficient the lower the resistance. Heat due to resistance is an ongoing problem with computers functioning properly. That's the reason for all the fans and why laptops and cell phones shut off if they get too hot. If computer processors can operate with no resistance, they can function very powerfully. Okay? Until 1986, extremely low temperatures were required for materials to become superconductive, a state at which electricity encounters no resistance. Ultra-low temperatures were achieved by submerging materials in liquid helium, the temperature of which is a frosty minus 452 degrees Fahrenheit. If helium gets any warmer than minus 452 degrees Fahrenheit, it will turn into gas. Helium is kept in a liquid state by pressurizing it inside a casing of liquid nitrogen, a much warmer minus 320 degrees Fahrenheit. If you dipped your tongue in liquid nitrogen for a taste, it would instantly freeze solid. Scientists who have performed this dubious experiment report that liquid nitrogen tastes a lot like Ben & Jerry's Cherry Garcia ice cream. In truth, they may actually be reporting that liquid nitrogen tastes like Häagen-Dazs' rum raisin ice cream. It's just very hard to understand what they are saying. In 1986, scientists discovered metallic ceramics that were superconductive with only liquid nitrogen. Remember, only minus 320 degrees Fahrenheit, not the colder minus 452 degrees Fahrenheit. Large universities were elated that superconductivity could be achieved at warmer temperatures. Aside from the cumbersome nature of working with liquid helium, superconductivity experiments were tearing science departments apart and causing precious grant money to evaporate. I'll explain. As anyone who has held a balloon knows, helium is very light. Slightly loosen your grip on a helium balloon and it shoots skyward. Few, though, realize what happens when helium is compressed in the liquefaction process. Highly concentrated helium is extremely dangerous because it is super light and exerts tens, even hundreds of thousands of pounds of upward buoyancy. In the old days, superconductivity experiment teams working with ultralight liquid helium would be struck with terror when they heard the ear-splitting screech of tearing metal and would have but seconds to exit buildings in order to survive. Although these catastrophes have been hidden from the public, vessels containing liquid helium would rip away from even strongly fortified supports and hurtle upwards. In more fortunate instances, levitating vessels would shatter ceilings, allowing the renegade containers to escape into the atmosphere. However, when laboratories were located in university basements, which typically doubled as bomb shelters, ceilings proved impregnable. The liquid helium vessels slammed against these impenetrable laboratory ceilings so forcefully that entire science wings would rip from their foundations and launch into the sky. When constructed, no one had the foresight to anchor science buildings properly against extreme skyward thrust. When the FAA got wind of these astronomically lethal university buildings careening towards the heavens and the dangers they posed to aircraft, they turned up the pressure and schools cooled to the idea of funding any more liquid helium projects. However, scientists are clever, and they started lashing down laboratory buildings with 4-inch-thick steel cables. Specially modified bulldozers with earwig-like pincers in place of digging apparatus stood ready for worst-case scenarios. They were always on alert to grab the cables of imminently airborne buildings. Weightlifting teams were recruited to hold down the bulldozers. One slip of the pincers, though, and all observers would tearfully watch their beloved science buildings, steel cables flapping in the wind, zoom heavenward, getting smaller and smaller, never to be seen again. You couldn't help wondering whether these buildings would eventually come down in an Iowa bean patch or in the Indian Ocean. And if found, would anyone bother to call the 800 number now routinely affixed to science washroom facilities and department heads? One lab came down in the middle of a Southern Baptist revival. The preacher dubbed himself He-Man and began practicing faith helium. Much like when dental fillings fall out, larger holes have to be drilled for buildings to be replanted in those successfully reeled back to Earth. At reinstallation ceremonies, stately deans take turns solemnly opening the valves and passing gas until all the pressure is relieved. For days afterwards, classes are taught by the Munchkin voiced. Today, to the great relief of scientists and universities worldwide, because only liquid nitrogen is now used, even large-scale superconductivity experiments require nothing more than sandbags. We are coming to the end of a show called The Mystic Pete Chronicles. If you'd like to reach me, I'm at mysticpete.com. We started the show, as always, with a story by the extraordinary Mike Bone called The Can Opener. Then music by Jean-Michel Jarre, interspersed with selections from classic literature. The tunes we heard from Zuluk were Ethnicolor, Diva, Zulukology, Wulumulu, Zuluk, and Blah Blah Cafe. His name is spelled J-E-A-N hyphen M-I-C-H-E-L-J-A-R-R-E. This is from 1984. We wrapped up the show with a story I wrote called The Dangers of Helium. Thank you so much for listening. Mystic Pete out!